Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Dr. Steve Jones has been one of the sentinel figures in breast cancer clinical research for more than three decades, and he's also a superb storyteller, an oncologic cowboy who can spin a yarn around the campfire with the best of them. In the mid-1970s, Steve had a leadership role in studying what has become the most common adjuvant systemic therapy of early breast cancer, AC, or doxorubicin cyclophosphamide, but like a new gunslinger in town, at last December's San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, Dr. Jones reported on a U.S. oncology trial demonstrating that another adjuvant regimen, TC, or docetaxel cyclophosphamide, had an efficacy and safety advantage over AC. I asked Steve to discuss this fascinating story that's evolved over the last three decades.
There is a 30-year history. I just happened to sort of be along for the ride. The history goes back to the University of Arizona, where there were three faculty members, Brian Dury and Sid Salmon, both who were very interested in multiple myeloma, and myself, and I was sort of assigned to run the breast cancer clinic. So I did breast cancer and lymphoma. I'd been trained at Stanford. The only thing I knew was lymphoma. I think my 2 years of fellowship, I saw two patients with breast cancer during that time. But about a year after I was there, we started to see some patients with breast cancer. Sid Salmon had contacts at the National Cancer Institute and actually made arrangements to have multiple boxes of 10 milligrams of adriamycin, it's still an investigational drug, shipped out from the National Cancer Institute. They were actually just sort of stored in our offices. And he had been on some kind of board at the National Cancer Institute. And in the middle of all that, they always would bring up Skipper and Schaible from the Southern Research Institute. And they went ahead and did some laboratory studies where they actually showed that adriamycin and cyclophosphamide were synergistic. So Sid had the idea we should combine these two drugs together, and I put together the clinical schedule. At that time, if you kind of keep in mind, 30 years ago, there were no venous access devices. This was really the first drug that was kind of a vesicant. We knew nitrogen mustard was, but we knew this drug could cause problems if it infiltrated. And every single dose that was given by the nurses was an adventure, because you never quite knew what was going to happen. Oncology nursing was just getting started at the time as well. So what I did is I put together a schedule of intravenous adriamycin followed by 4 days of oral cyclophosphamide. And the cyclophosphamide dose was pretty reasonable even by today's standards, 200 per meter squared per day for 4 days. So it was 800 milligrams per meter squared. And the adriamycin when we started out was really pretty low, 30 milligrams per meter squared, but we gradually inched up because no one quite knew what the toxicity was. And we ended up with a regimen in metastatic breast cancer that by clinical responses produced about an 80% response rate and got published in Cancer, which was really the journal at that time, 1975. So now we kind of leap ahead 30 years to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Conference, and that's where the results of the TC regimen came. But honestly, the AC regimen wouldn't have come about if Sid Salmon didn't have the contacts at the National Cancer Institute, didn't know the basic science part of this, and hadn't managed to get boxes and boxes of adriamycin shipped to us so we could put together studies. Now, AC obviously emerged, but we did AC for everything. No one remembers that. We did it in lung cancer. It was okay in small cell. Did it in ovarian cancer, and that was kind of okay. And we did it in melanoma and everything else, too, where it really wasn't so good as a regimen. It was really a pretty broad phase, too. And then we went on in 1974, we really started doing adjuvant studies. And we've initially started a study for women with positive nodes, and about a year later moved it into women with negative nodes. And I remember one time I was at a conference at the National Cancer Institute where I presented some of the early data on node-negative breast cancer giving AC. And I was in the parking lot, crossing the parking lot of the National Cancer Institute when a car tried to run me down. And it was Rose Kushner, one of the original breast cancer advocates, who leaped out of her car, got in my face and said, "You can't do this to women. This is criminal." And little do we know, 30 years later, we're doing this routinely, and we're actually doing a lot of other chemotherapy to women with negative lymph nodes.
I can remember her at ASCO meetings and everywhere else standing up and raising hell. She was an interesting person.
She was. Yeah, she had metastatic cancer, and she would come to all these meetings, and she was really tied to Bernie Fisher. Wherever he would go, she would kind of be there. But, you know, in the original San Antonio breast cancer meetings, I think this last one might have been like the 28th, we were invited. I went and presented the original AC data in metastatic disease and then in adjuvant disease. So the first few meetings were by invitation alone. You know, it was under 100 people, one room. You kind of contrast that 30 years later with 7,800 people from all different countries. Pretty amazing difference. The other part of the story is that Sid Salmon and I put on a series of conferences called Adjuvant Therapy of Cancer,
right,
which 80% had to do with breast cancer. And those started in the late 70s. You know, we would do it every 2 or 3 years. It's long before the internet. You know, people would make a presentation. It would take a year or more to get the paper published in some journal. And so what we demanded of all the speakers, and everyone did it for $100 or whatever it was to produce a manuscript at the time of the meeting. They wouldn't get their $100 unless they did that. So everybody brought their manuscripts, and we did it in a camera-ready format, and we had a publishing company that would just sort of photograph these pages, and the thing would be published, the whole book would be published in about 3 to 4 months after the meeting.
Yeah, I remember those books and those meetings, and there was a lot of other stuff besides breast cancer. I mean, a lot of tumors were covered.
There were, where there was any kind of data. Some of it was a little stretch. I mean, we would do adjuvant chemo for Hodgkin's disease because the primary treatment was radiotherapy. We'd get Saul Rosenberg to come and discuss adjuvant chemo. But, you know, I think that those meetings were also important because NSABP and Bernie Fisher, every one of those meetings would come and present an update on the NSABP.
Right.
And Gianni Bonadonna would come and present the Milan studies. And every year I'd present the little pilot phase 2 data on AC and adjuvant. And every time we had that meeting, we tried to ask Bernie Fisher to introduce Adriamycin into the NSABP. And meeting after meeting came and went, and he was focused on the melphalan studies. And it really took quite some period of time before Adriamycin was introduced. But, you know, once they did that, then they really did the key studies that defined the dose and schedule and came up with the current 60 per meter square of doxorubicin and 600 per meter square cyclophosphamide, proving that higher doses weren't necessary and so on.
When along the way did the issue of cardiomyopathy come up?
That came up really pretty early on. In fact, we were working with one of our cardiologists who's still a faculty member at the University of Arizona. He had some kind of little technique for measuring. It was really not measuring ejection fraction, but it was some kind of another technique that he thought could predict cardiomyopathy. So we did a whole series of studies with him trying to show cardiac toxicity. And we also got involved pretty early on in studies with what's now Zinicard that I don't think anyone even actively promotes to try to prevent cardiac toxicity. But there certainly was interest even before people were doing echoes or doing MUGA scans. Those techniques didn't even exist. That's kind of the story of AC, and it really built over a long period of time. And, you know, you practiced long enough to know we had a 20-year dry spell of no new drugs for breast cancer after the introduction of Adriamycin. And Adriamycin was introduced in the early 70s. It wasn't until the early 90s that the taxanes came along. And then with that, with the introduction of docetaxel, we really wanted to do studies in adjuvant setting, but there was a lot of concern about paclitaxel and Adriamycin together because of the studies that Gianni had done. And we really had no data at that point on docetaxel and Adriamycin. So Vicente Valero at MD Anderson had done some phase 1, phase 2 pilot study of docetaxel cyclophosphamide, the TC regimen, appeared to be devoid of cardiac toxicity. And we basically took his phase 1, phase 2 data and made up the TC regimen and then compared it to AC. So there were a lot of things that kind of came together at the same time that prompted us to do this.
So let's talk about the trial you reported.
Yeah, we reported a study that's relatively small, relatively underpowered, 1,000 patients. It was an adjuvant study in which we compared 4 cycles of standard dose AC to 4 cycles of what we consider now standard dose TC, which would be docetaxel at 75 milligrams per meter squared, and the same dose of cyclophosphamide, 600 milligrams per meter squared. There really were no dose reductions. We used full body surface area. You know, we didn't reduce dose if a patient had a very large body surface area. That's still the doses they received. Chemotherapy was given before radiation therapy or before tamoxifen. And we included higher risk node negative and women with positive nodes in this trial. Trial got stopped at one point. We sort of ran out of funds to do it, but then got it back up and running. You know, I think because of the timing when we started this in 1997, everyone was very interested in combining doxorubicin with the taxanes. But we didn't have enough data, we felt, to combine docetaxel with doxorubicin at that time. So consequently, we went this alternative route. And it sort of stands alone because this is the only non-anthracycline regimen that's kind of out there, if you think about it. I mean, there's CMF that's out there, or in the old days, you know, melphalan or L-phenylalanine mustard, but, you know, there really aren't other non-anthracycline regimens. And so this study kind of percolated along. We accrued the patients. This really started in the PRN research group and then became U.S. Oncology Research, and we were really kind of learning procedures and standard operating procedures and set up the computer system to capture all of the data and so on. We now have a pretty sophisticated system, but this was really in the beginning. And this is the first major adjuvant study that we've done within the U.S. Oncology Network.
So what did you say?
Well, 3 years ago, we presented the toxicity data at ASCO in a poster, and we presented the preliminary results based on number of events that there was a trend in favor of TC over AC. Now we really have the mature results based on over 170 events. That was the planned time for the final analysis. The median follow-up is 5.5 years. We have seen significantly fewer recurrences and events on the TC arm compared to AC. So the absolute difference in disease-free survival, and I emphasized at San Antonio, emphasized today, the endpoint of this trial was disease-free survival. It wasn't overall survival. That was a secondary endpoint. It was disease-free survival. So at 5 years, it's a difference between 86% for TC versus 80% for AC. So there's a 6% absolute difference. The reduction in risk is roughly one-third, and it's highly significant at the 0.01 level. There is a strong trend in favor of survival. I think there's a 3% absolute difference at 5 years, with about a 24% reduction in the odds of dying from a breast cancer if you receive TC. The other part of this was the toxicity. And I think in general, the toxicity was just a better tolerated regimen. I've used this a lot in patients in this trial and outside the trial. Patients just kind of go through this without too much difficulty. There's sort of low-grade docetaxel-type side effects like myalgias, arthralgias, edema. It's fairly transient. It really goes away pretty quickly. There was a little bit higher rate of fever and neutropenia. The actual numbers were 5.5% on the TC regimen and 2.5% on the AC regimen. We didn't use any prophylactic growth factors, but prophylactic antibiotics were used and were encouraged. That obviously varied from doctor to doctor who was putting patients on that trial, whether they did it or not. I did a lot of it. I rarely ever saw anybody with fever and neutropenia. But there was a difference. There's one case of congestive heart failure ended up being fatal on the AC arm, and no cases of congestive heart failure on the TC arm. Those, at least the AC, the rate's probably just a little bit low for what you'd expect to see. The usual figure that's, you know, thrown about is 0.5% to 1%. Fortunately, we haven't seen that kind of a rate, but I think there's no reason to think that TC would have any cardiac toxicity.
You know, it's interesting. We did a series of patient, quote, town meetings a couple years ago. We went to New York, Miami, and Houston, and we had a bunch of clinical investigators who presented issues to patients, and then all the patients had a keypad. We had about 1,000 people total in the three meetings. And one of the things we asked them about was how they rated different side effects. And one of the things that was interesting was, in spite of the researchers saying how low the risk of anthracycline cardiomyopathy is, it was one of the highest rated side effects from the patient point of view. They didn't like the idea. Does that jive with your own practice?
It does, and you know, it's just a disastrous complication that occurs. I mean, even if you're monitoring these patients, they're entirely healthy, everyone sees this. I mean, just 4 cycles of AC. It does concern me about where someone wants to use 6 cycles of AC, because you move from 240 milligrams per meter squared to 300 milligrams per meter squared, or 360. You know, I think the older data and the myocardial biopsies and things really suggest you're markedly increasing the risk of cardiac toxicity. Everybody probably has these. I have my one patient who had 4 cycles of AC, was in a study, got monitored with MUGA scans before and right after treatment. They were completely normal. 3 months later, she was in florid heart failure. She had a very high-risk breast cancer. No one would do anything until they made sure she was not going to die of the breast cancer. But 3 years out, she had a heart transplant for that.
Wow.
And she's alive and well and comes back and thanks me for this.
Wow. How old is she?
She is in her mid-50s.
Wow.
But it was a disastrous complication, and her heart is functioning well 6 or 7, 8 years now from diagnosis. The cancer never came back, but she has to take all the suppressive medicines to keep her heart from being rejected. You know, it's just a disastrous complication. We all have these patients that have, you know, varying degrees of congestive heart failure. It sort of is controlled, but they're always on medications. You know, it may slowly get better over a period of time. But if you had a regimen that could avoid it, that obviously would be attractive.
What did you see in terms of alopecia?
It's interesting. Alopecia is one of those things that I think is not kept track of. It's so expected by the oncologist and the oncology nurses and even the patients that you see reports of regimens where they report 40% alopecia. And yet, you know, every single patient on a trial had lost their hair. And this is true here. We didn't really keep track of it, but basically it's, you know, it's 100% alopecia. I mean, the difference between wig or no wig. So if you have to wear a wig, then, you know, you might still have 15% of your hair, but so what?
But both arms?
But both arms. I really couldn't see any difference.
Any difference that you observed taking care of patients in terms of quality of life, fatigue, you know, maybe things that go beyond the numbers in terms of the two regimens?
One of the interesting things about TC is that, and I've been a big fan of AC. I gave you the history of why I'm a fan of it, and I like to use a lot of AC. But when we crunched the toxicity numbers, there was significantly more grade 3 and 4 nausea and vomiting with AC. That's despite all the modern antiemetics. You really still couldn't prevent it in everybody. And kind of all grades, it was significantly higher than with TC, and certainly grade 3 and 4. And that's just unpleasant side effect. You just didn't see that with TC. You do get a little bit of these docetaxel type of side effects, and sometimes patients get a little neuropathy, but you didn't see fatigue with it. I mean, I was just amazed, generally, how much better tolerated that was in AC, and I was a strong believer in AC.
I know that the trial had about 1,000 patients in it.
Yeah, 1,016 patients.
So, you know, probably there weren't enough to address a question that people are talking a lot about now, which is the impact of chemotherapy based on estrogen receptor status. What did you find, though, in your data?
Well, that is an issue. About 70% of these women were ER or PR positive, so the majority were. We did a exploratory analysis, which is the nice term when you want to kind of go back and look at some of these factors. In a small trial, you end up with very small subgroups, but we did look at ER, PR negative versus anybody who had estrogen or progesterone receptor positive, and basically we saw the same benefit of TC across the board. It really was not different. And kind of thinking about it, it really isn't any different than the TAC versus FAC. I mean, those two regimens have three drugs. We have two drugs. We've taken out a lot of the toxicity by taking out the adriamycin, you know, like in the TAC regimen, because we now just have TC and you don't have the severe toxicity. In the TAC versus FAC study, they had central laboratory review, and I think TAC was equally effective in ER positive as well as ER negative. And we see the same trends. The numbers of some of these groups are pretty small, but the forest plot of the hazard ratios really indicate equal benefit. We also looked at the two pre-stratification factors, which one was age and the other was nodal status. And again, kind of across the board, the treatment effect was there.
Just to divert out to that question, what are your thoughts about some of the debates that have gone on about this ER-positive issue? Does dose-dense AC paclitaxel, is it as effective as, for example, TAC in ER-positive patients? What are your thoughts about that controversy?
It is interesting because I think we are seeing some data that seems to break out on the basis of estrogen receptor. If I told you the patient was HER2-positive, then everyone needs to get Herceptin. That's kind of a no-brainer. But people haven't generally been thinking about if someone's ER positive, should they get a different kind of chemo? And Cliff Hunnis updated the dose dense right at the same time I did the ACTC presentation. So the room appeared relatively empty, but I guess there were still 1,500 people in the room. with 9,000 chairs, it looked pretty empty. So Cliff and I presented to each other.
That was on the last morning.
On the last morning. I think most people didn't even know San Antonio went into Sunday and they were on planes or already at home. Next year they'll know. But seeing their update, and again, he did this sort of unplanned exploratory analysis of receptor. And, you know, Cliff's description of this would be that there was less evidence of benefit in the ER positive. My description would be I didn't see any evidence of benefit in ER positive. Now, both of those are probably a little extreme. There might be something that could show up in a long period of time. But obviously, almost all of the treatment results in their first study of adding paclitaxel to AC or in the update of Dostense, almost all the treatment effect appears to be an ER negative. And yet now we have TAC seems to be equally effective in ER positive. TC appears to be equally positive. Another presentation that morning that followed mine was Professor Martin from the GICAM, the Spanish group. It was slightly a trial that didn't have exactly equal duration in there. It had four cycles of FEC 90, not FEC 100 or FEC 60 or FEC 90, followed by eight doses of weekly paclitaxel versus six cycles of FEC 90. So the paclitaxel arm was slightly longer duration. But having said that, he saw a reduction in disease-free survival or improvement in disease-free survival with adding weekly paclitaxel, and there was a trend in survival, and it appeared to be equally effective in ER-positive versus ER-negative. So I think we are seeing some of these regimens where there is some difference. You know, this comes up within U.S. Oncology and our breast committee and discussions. You know, there are people that really like using Dostense. But I think at this point, I don't see the big advantage in somebody with ER-positive disease using Dostense chemotherapy.
What do you think that's all about? Do you think it's the taxane in terms of paclitaxel versus docetaxel? You just talked about another study where it was seen with paclitaxel. What do you think it all means?
I'm not sure what it all means. It might be, you know, more related to the taxane. It might be more related to the schedule. I think in the GICAM study, weekly paclitaxel was clearly effective. You know, dose dense isn't quite weekly. It's every other week. And so maybe it's more of the schedule. Maybe if they had done weekly, you know, you would see this effect in ER positive. But it is kind of an interesting observation. It seems now to be repeated over and over again. You know, I think we're at the point you do have to start to think about what regimens you're using. Now, having said that, everyone's sort of plunging into dose dense for everything. You know, like the NSABP is looking at TAC versus AC paclitaxel dose dense and AC paclitaxel gemcitabine dose dense.
What are you using off-study in your typical node-positive patient?
Well, we've just completed enrollment on our third U.S. Oncology adjuvant study. The second one has been presented, but we kept it relatively quiet. We didn't declare victory. We can come back and talk about that. But the third study was AC followed by docetaxel, every three-week schedule, or AC followed by Zolota Taxotere, the XT regimen. And Joyce O'Shaughnessy is the principal investigator on that trial. So the accrual has just been completed. That's really the major test of XT as part of an adjuvant regimen. We'll have to see how that pans out. In the context of practice, if you present to a patient that you think standard treatment's AC followed by docetaxel, then it's pretty hard, if she decides not to go on a trial, to recommend something that you haven't even really kind of discussed with her. So I think a lot of us use AC followed by docetaxel.
Is that what you're doing now that the study's over?
Well, I think you get into habits, so I think a lot of that's habits. I think we see a lot of things within U.S. Oncology. I mean, Dostense is used for a lot of patients. Some people are starting to use TC more, but I think there's still people want to see the manuscript in detail and kind of think about this a little bit. I mean, we've got 30-year history of AC. It's just hard to say one day you should abandon it. I mean, I've heard people say that, but I've also heard the other extreme is, you know, I would use this in somebody who has cardiac disease and I wouldn't take a chance with Adriamycin, then I would use TC, but that's the only place I would use it.
Yeah, I find that pretty interesting. It will be interesting once you get it published whether they change their viewpoint. I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been more excitement about it. One of the issues that I hear brought up by people who are not that excited about this is a study, I believe it was an ECOG study that Lori Goldstein reported of AT versus AC. And I'm not exactly sure why that's relevant to yours, but can you go through what that study showed and whether you think it is relevant to the TC?
Sure. Well, I think it is relevant in our manuscript that we just submitted. It's the one study I picked out to kind of compare, because the ECOT, that trial was a larger study, involved 3,000 women. I think two-thirds were node negative, third were node positive. And, you know, in the beginning, by 1997, had we had the data, I think we would have liked to combine probably adriamycin and docetaxel, which is what they did, and compare it to AC. You know, we didn't feel we were comfortable enough to do that, so we did TC and took the adriamycin out. They had absolutely no difference in outcome. I think it was 87 or 88% disease-free survival at 4 years in both arms. I mean, the curves are absolutely superimposable. You can do some subgroup analysis. I try to refrain from doing that. It's hard to do. You run a big trial like this, people want to do subgroups. They just sort of can't help themselves. And then you get some interesting variation where one subgroup shows something that's positive. But if the overall results are completely superimposable, if one subgroup's positive, then some other subgroup is going to have a negative effect. But I think, you know, looking at that trial overall, there was no difference in outcome, survival or disease-free survival. But in general, the results are much better than we sort of would have predicted historically. That's true in our trial, too. These results are better than I think we would have predicted 10 years ago we would be seeing. But having said that, then you have to try to explain, if TC is better than AC, why AT was not. And that's the hard one to kind of explain. Part of the difference could be we used a higher dose of docetaxel. We used 75 milligrams per meter squared. In that trial, they used 60 and 60. There is a dose-response relationship in metastatic breast cancer with docetaxel. Mortensen has a paper that will be coming out looking at different dose levels in metastatic disease. The numbers of patients aren't huge, but clearly the lower dose, like 60 per meter squared, is not quite as good as 75 per meter squared, and that isn't quite as good as 100 per meter squared. Some of those differences aren't statistically significant, but the trend is there. So we used a higher dose of docetaxel. We didn't cap doses based on body surface area. We didn't reduce doses. And, you know, really, there may be a lot more synergism between docetaxel and cyclophosphamide than you would kind of guess. I mean, those are the reasons I sort of speculated. But in the end, we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing that I thought about. Maybe there is some synergy between docetaxel and cyclophosphamide. I mean, actually, in a way, that's kind of what your study suggests.
That is what the study suggests. And, you know, I think people kind of get away. You know, cyclophosphamide is just this kind of drug that's in the background anymore, but it was one of the active drugs. You know, we've done this other adjuvant study in U.S. oncology research that David Lesh is the principal investigator on. It was presented at San Antonio a couple years ago. So the first trial was ACTC. The last trial has not been reported as AC followed by XT. But the middle trial, we actually took the cyclophosphamide out. So we did adriamycin and paclitaxel. That was the different AT, followed by weekly paclitaxel for 12 doses. So there's not a single drop of cyclophosphamide in that. And then we compared it to AC followed by paclitaxel every 3 weeks. And what David has reported was a significant improvement in disease-free survival and overall survival at 3 years. We were very cautious about that.
With the AT. Right.
We're very cautious about that. We didn't think that it was sort of ready for prime time. People shouldn't go home and use it. A lot of paclitaxel in there, a fair amount of neurotoxicity with that regimen. But, you know, within the next year or so, that'll be ready for like the 5-year update. So that'll be very interesting to see. But 3 years, we actually saw pretty significant benefit without the cyclophosphamide.
You were talking about the capecitabine study that you guys just got through. What happened to 5-FU along the way? You know, we had CAF and then, you know, come out with a pretty interesting drug in capecitabine. And I kind of wondered why we sort of gave up on fluoropyrimidines in the adjuvant setting.
It's a question that we've asked from time to time. I've kind of come to the conclusion it's not worth answering. You know, when we developed our AC studies in the mid-70s, MD Anderson was developing FAC at the same time. They really were done in parallel, virtually at the same time. I mean, they didn't have Sid Salmon to get them the little vials of adriamycin like we had, but they put that together, and we would report these at the same meetings. They were doing single-arm studies, if you remember back then. We were doing single-arm studies. And if you really look at those early results, they were virtually identical. The duration of response and survival appeared to be very similar between AC or FAC. You know, MD Andersons continue to do FAC, but their FAC is different than most people's FAC.
I always wonder why people didn't utilize capecitabine alone as a single agent after they were finished with their anthracycline taxane.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable idea. You always ask this question of everybody who ever comes on your program, how they use capecitabine and the toxicity. And, you know, Joanne Blum is one of my colleagues, and she really ran our original capecitabine studies. And, you know, the dose was too high, and it took a while for people to figure that out. And I think moving that into an adjuvant setting seemed pretty risky. Now it would be much less risky to think about doing that.
What was your take on the intergroup study that Joe Sperano reported at San Antonio on AC followed by taxanes at different schedules?
Yeah, that was a long-awaited result, 5,000 women, 2x2 factorial design. What's sort of interesting, and I haven't had a chance to ask him directly about this, but you know, the plan in that trial was to report after they had 1,050 events. And what they reported was about 850. So they're roughly 200 events less than what they planned to do their sort of first planned analysis and report. The argument I remember him saying was he didn't think longer follow-up make a difference, and their statisticians and data safety monitoring committee didn't think longer follow-up make a difference. But you still have to wonder. It wasn't the original statistical plan. So having said that, then all those regimens look pretty much the same at the end. With the exception, he had a slide that I actually like to show because it suggests kind of consistent with what a lot of oncologists do anyway. And if you kind of look that there's 1,200 or so patients per treatment arm, and if you look at just the number of breast cancer relapses, and roughly I think the numbers were 200 or so, there were two arms that had events something like 170, 20 to 30 events fewer. And it was the arm with weekly paclitaxel, and it was the arm with docetaxel every 3 weeks. And that's what lots of people do. I mean, your patterns of care and so on, people give AC followed by docetaxel, or they give AC followed by weekly paclitaxel. So I think in my take on that study was it really kind of supports both of those as reasonable treatments. The other thing that's interesting, because I think we keep seeing this over and over in the docetaxel studies, is this sort of 16 to 17% rate of fever and neutropenia with docetaxel as a single agent. And as you know, your former partner down here, Chuck Vogel, did the study of docetaxel with and without pegfilgrastim and showed a 17% rate of fever and neutropenia versus 1% if you got pegfilgrastim. And I think, you know, that's the whole basis for the sort of extended indication for prophylactic pegfilgrastim, you know, for regimens that have a rate of febrile neutropenia of 17% or so. You know, it makes me think if I'm going to use docetaxel in a lot of patients, I would probably try to get pegfilgrastim for them. I mean, 17% rate of fever and neutropenia is just too high.
Is that what you were seeing in your adjuvant study where you had AC followed by docetaxel or docetaxel capecitabine?
We haven't seen any data on that. In our ACTC study, what we saw was we saw a higher rate of fever and neutropenia. The actual numbers are 5.5% for TC, but that's a far cry from 16 or 17%. And in the AC arm, it was 2.5%. You know, those are the numbers I usually think about with AC or FAC, you know, that there's just really no justification for prophylactic white blood cell growth factors or regimens that have a 2.5-3% rate of fever and neutropenia. Maybe they're special patients or older patients or patients who had severe, profound neutropenia even without fever the first course, you might think about it. There are some studies predicting for subsequent rates of fever and neutropenia. But I do think you have to start thinking about this just for routine care. I mean, if it was you or I getting adjuvant chemo and we ended up in the hospital for 4 days and fever and IV antibiotics and all the things that go along with it, it's really, you know, pretty serious complication. It's not that you're going to die from it. It just really interrupts the whole treatment, makes you think about, is this worthwhile? Should I take any more treatment? I mean, I've certainly had patients in the past who have refused any further treatment if that happens to them. And you're trying to give them assurances you can keep it from happening the next time, knowing in your heart that hopefully you can, but maybe you can't.
So when you use AC followed by docetaxel, do you use preemptive growth factors for the docetaxel?
Generally, I don't, but I really am starting to think about that. And I guess I would do it more on a case-by-case basis. You know, you sort of see docetaxel being used, at least the full dose, in younger patients. That's sort of kind of what I see, you know, where you have a little less chance of that. But in the older patient, some comorbidities, I think the justification is pretty close to being there.
What's the next U.S. Oncology adjuvant trial you guys are thinking of?
That's a good question. We have piloted AC dose dance followed by Abraxane dose dance. And Abraxane dose dance is interesting because only about a third of the time do you sort of need growth factors with that. Two-thirds of the time, the counts recover by 2 weeks and you can kind of go ahead with the next treatment without growth factors.
And that was reported by Nick Robert at the San Antonio meeting.
Nick Robert reported that. That was a pilot of 30 patients or so. We have been kind of working on that would probably be our next study. We're in the process of rethinking this at the moment. I think the world has kind of changed with the introduction of Avastin. Suddenly everyone wants to put Avastin into the adjuvant setting with the hope that it'll be the next Herceptin for the HER2 negative population, which is 80% of breast cancer that we see.
I don't want to ask you about Avastin, but I'm kind of sticking with the issue of the adjuvant trial. So you haven't really come to a decision about what you're going to do at this point?
We have not come to a final decision at this point. The other thing that we're at least thinking about is doing something further with the TC regimen. Up to this point, it stands alone. There are no other studies with TC. No one's using it. The thing that immediately comes to mind, since TC was better than AC, what about combining it with trastuzumab or Herceptin in the HER2-positive population? And we have the B-Surge 06 trial that was just reported, where the other TC, and that's the Taxotere Carbo plus Herceptin, wasn't quite as good as the anthracycline-based regimens with Herceptin. At least if you just kind of look at the curves, you know, there's that sort of separation of disease-free survival curves. And Dr. Slayman's been very careful to point out there's only 20 events different between those. But still looking at it, you wouldn't rush to pick Taxotere, Carboplatin, Herceptin as your frontline regimen if it's not quite as good. Now, maybe with longer follow-up, that difference will disappear. Dr. Slayman has put forward the Topo-2 isomerase hypothesis. Try and explain this. That may well be right. We may end up with, you know, one treatment for the non-amplified Topo isomerase 2 patients and another treatment for the ones that are amplified. But having said all that, we now have a regimen up front, TC, that offers a significant improvement in disease-free survival compared to AC. And we've not had that before. And you don't have the cardiac issue with it. So you really could think about combining that with Herceptin, either concurrently or immediately after the chemotherapy. So that's another regimen we're thinking about. We can't go back and do a regimen of TC with or without Herceptin. I think that's no longer an ethical thing. But you could look at sequencing, you know, concurrent or sequential, for example, just to get some toxicity data.
When do you think that the current adjuvant study that's just completed would include the XT will be ready for a presentation?
Well, one of the things that's interesting, we have to be patient. Just sort of look at the track record. We started our ACTC study in 1997, and we end up reporting it in 2005. So that's 8 years. And that's probably fairly typical. You know, the NSABP, typically it's 8 years after they start a study is when they report it. Now, this study just completed its accrual, so it's 2 years into that. Maybe another 3 years we can get first look, you know, preliminary analysis. But the mature data is about 8 years.
What are some of the other trials that are going on right now with U.S. Oncology and breast cancer?
Well, Frankie Holmes, who is one of our partners in Texas Oncology in the Houston area, was MD Anderson for a long time, is the principal investigator on a neoadjuvant study. It's our first foray into the neoadjuvant world. We didn't know how well that would accrue or how well it would do. We're doing in conjunction with Dr. Puzdai at MD Anderson. So fine needle aspirate samples are collected. They're being sent off for genetic analysis by Dr. Puzdai. And we're seeing if we can predict pathologic complete response. There, what we've done, we've used FEC 100 for four cycles, followed by XT for four cycles, but it's a single arm study. And then a little late into this, because of Dr. Buzdar's neoadjuvant Herceptin data, we have added a FISH positive, HER2 positive arm. So that arm would get FEC 75, reducing the epirubicin dose a little bit, followed by XT. And that arm is still open, I believe. It still needs a few more patients. The other has completed accrual, and I don't know if we'll have some data in time for San Antonio or not.
Now, for the HER2 positive, when do you give the trastuzumab?
It's being given just like Dr. Buzdar did in his neoadjuvant, weekly, concurrently during the first 6 months of treatment.
So obviously then it's going to be given concurrently with the FEC.
Yes. He reported some updated cases at San Antonio, another 22 patients, I believe, where didn't see any extra evidence of cardiac toxicity. There's some fall in ejection fractions, but nothing dramatic that comes out that would say you shouldn't do this.
I'm curious what your discussions and thoughts have been about the WIND study that was presented by Rowan Schabowski last year, looking at dietary fat reduction, talking about, you know, trying to find funding for trials. I can't imagine where you'd find funding to do something like that. But what were your thoughts about those data? And have you talked about maybe somehow incorporating that into what you do?
Yeah, Rowan had the misfortune of being in a plenary session right after all the Herceptin data got presented. So he was in a large room where there couldn't have been more than 200 people in there. But I was there. I heard it. I thought it was very exciting. He did a very nice, well-conducted trial reducing dietary fat and saw the same kind of magnitude of improvement in disease-free survival that we've seen with chemotherapy interventions. But he lost his funding. Even as the thing was becoming mature, he lost his R01 grant and really had a scramble to try to come up and do the follow-up and present that. So he did make the Today Show, got interviewed by Katie Couric. But I think it's sort of one of those interesting things, but you know, most oncologists think just sort of set it aside.
Is it something that you bring up to your patients?
I'm probably just as guilty as everyone else in not bringing that up. I mean, you know, patients always do have those questions about diet and what should we do, change our lifestyle to keep the cancer from coming back. And I guess that is part of the discussion. It could try to reduce their dietary fat. You know, I think the interesting part was it wasn't just drastic weight loss. It was really a reduction in dietary fat that persisted, but it was a very labor-intensive effort of counseling to kind of keep those patients on that fat restriction diet, and it appeared to make a benefit.
And the interesting thing was, they actually saw more benefit in ER-negative tumors, which is a little bit counterintuitive.
Yes, that's correct.
It's just kind of, you know, reflecting what you just said about funding, it's just kind of interesting that when an intervention comes along that, you know, nobody's really going to profit by, it looks like it kind of dies. I mean, if we'd seen those kind of curves with a, you know, pharmacologic agent, I would imagine somebody would have been all over it.
No, absolutely. If it was a drug that did that, people would be jumping on it. Stock would be skyrocketing.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, it was funny too, because, you know, at the same time, they were presenting the data in colon cancer from the trial looking at IFL versus 5-FU alone. It was a flop. It didn't work. But then they reported an interesting subset analysis or analysis based on the data that had come into the trial showing that there was a marked correlation between exercise and relapse rate, almost a 50% decrease in relapse rate in people who exercised regularly. And again, you know, nobody noticed it. If the IFL part of the study had to show the same thing, we'd be using IFL right now.
Yeah, it is interesting how that works. You have to have a sponsor.
You mentioned Avastin before, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about the Avastin data, both from the point of view of future clinical research as well as sort of daily patient care.
You know, the Avastin story, I think, is an interesting one because it's basically, as far as I can tell, and you know this well, you go to all the different meetings, I just focus on breast cancer, but it seems to work pretty much in almost every tumor type it's been studied in. And this guy, Rakesh Jain, who's done some of the basic science work, may think it's a difference of how the drug's getting into the cancer cell and intratumoral pressure within the cancer cell and so on. There may be a much more general mechanism other than sort of anti-VEGF kind of mechanism. But regardless, it is clearly active in breast cancer. I think the study that Kathy Miller reported, had that study been negative, I think it would have disappeared in breast cancer. but it wasn't negative, and it has the same order of benefit that we saw combining trastuzumab to chemotherapy in metastatic disease. And of course, suddenly, everyone's very excited about moving this into the adjuvant setting. Now, we've had a chance to see it a couple times. She presented it at ASCO, and then she updated it at San Antonio. She keeps stressing, rightfully so, the survival update is not mature yet at this point, but there certainly is a trend there in terms of survival. Kind of what I hear from oncologists around the country is that some are able to get it for patients with metastatic disease and others aren't. A lot of times what they're being told by their insurance company is, go ahead and give this and then we'll evaluate your claim. But, you know, you could be, you know, $50,000 in the hole before you find out they're not going to pay for it. And I don't see a lot of oncologists in the current climate willing to sort of take that chance in metastatic breast cancer. But, you know, I'd be in meetings and I'll ask, you know, how many of you in the room have used it? And there's always people that have raised their hand, been able to use it for patients with metastatic breast cancer. There are studies underway. We're just initiating a trial looking at Avastin, basically along with every other single agent, sort of the other single agent with and without Avastin, to prove efficacy with gemcitabine, with Taxotere, with Adriamycin, with Capecitabine, and we have one also with Abraxane.
So this is a phase two?
These are randomized studies, but I think it's a 2-to-1 randomization favoring Avastin. If the patient doesn't get it, they could get Avastin at the time they progress. The idea is just to try to get the same kind of data for the other active agents in breast cancer to help bolster, you know, getting that approved.
Interesting. If the drug does get approved and does get reimbursed, how do you see it fitting into the algorithm?
That's a good question. If a patient who recurs with metastatic disease, there are a lot of different options for treatment with different kinds of chemotherapy. But this is one because of the different mechanism of action. I'm one of those oncologists that like to use single agents and not use combinations very often. I'd be much more inclined to use it in combination. I mean, to use single agent in combination with Avastin, just for the sort of added benefit. You know, right now we only have the paclitaxel data. So if someone's had previous paclitaxel, relapsed quickly, probably not really a candidate for it. But, you know, I think in even a Kathy Miller study, there were some of those patients that had adjuvant paclitaxel. And at the time they relapsed, then were treated with paclitaxel plus Avastin.
Getting back to the TC study, what's your take on the side effects profile of docetaxel compared to paclitaxel?
Well, I was the first author on the study that just got reported in JCO in August 2005. It took quite a while to get that paper published, but that was the Taxotere 311 trial, in which we directly compared paclitaxel with docetaxel at their FDA-approved doses and schedule. That was every three-week basis. And there was clearly a lot more hematologic toxicity with docetaxel than there was paclitaxel, but there was a higher response rate and time to tumor progression and survival advantage for docetaxel. You know, having said that, what's happened in the last 12 years or so is, you know, weekly paclitaxel has been introduced, which is probably somewhere, in my view, somewhere in between with a lot less toxicity other than some neurotoxicity. And so, you know, I think that's kind of stepped up, and we see that in the adjuvant setting these days. So I think it's sort of the full approved every three-week doses. Docetaxel is a more active drug. If you go back in the adjuvant setting where you really have kind of the same situation, every three-week docetaxel versus every three-week paclitaxel, it's pretty hard to show it, other than if you look at a fewer relapses of breast cancer occurred in docetaxel every 3 weeks and in the weekly paclitaxel arm. So it's kind of consistent with that.
What's your take on Abraxane?
We've done a lot of phase two work with Abraxane in metastatic breast cancer. We've done the weekly schedules. Joanne Blum has been the principal investigator for U.S. oncology research on those trials. It's an active regimen, does have some neurotoxicity, but it's very well tolerated and given in a short period of time. I think the big part of that is just this novel formulation, a way to deliver the drug, and that's what makes it really very intriguing. And there are other drugs potentially that could be given that way as well.
There are two things that are often pointed out about that agent. One is a lack of need for pre-medication, and the other is a shorter infusion time. How much of an advantage do you see for either one of those things?
Well, I think the lack of pre-medication is a big advantage. And some patients really don't do very well with a lot of steroid pre-medication. They can't sleep and they may not feel so well. So I think that's an issue, either paclitaxel or docetaxel. You know, steroids for docetaxel are, you know, anywhere from 2.5 to 5 days, kind of depending on what pre-medication regimen you want to use. So I think that's a big plus. The amount of chair time and so on, depending how busy you are, could be an advantage. The lack of special tubing and so on could be an advantage. So I think the drug is really trying to find its niche at the moment. It technically got approved as a generic paclitaxel because of its novel formulation. But I think science appears to be there, and I think we're going to see the development of other cancer drugs given exactly the same kind of way.
Are you using it right now in a non-protocol setting?
We use it on selected patients. I think that's probably the best way to answer it. You know, I think I sort of see that around the country as well.
What kind of patients?
Patients who may not have had paclitaxel before. I think our oncologists, U.S. oncologists, are going to use it, are probably more likely to use it on our phase 2 weekly schedule where it's very well tolerated.
What's your take on the neurotoxicity compared to paclitaxel, particularly when using weekly regimens for both?
Yeah, you definitely get neurotoxicity with this, but it comes and goes very quickly. That's the interesting part. I think you don't have the cremophore sticking to the neurons or something like that, you know, because you don't have those drugs like Tween 80 or cremophore that are in the mix. So you do get the neurotoxicity, but 2-3 weeks, it really resolves very quickly. And I think even in Nick Robert's pilot study of dose-dense Abraxane, there was some neurotoxicity. There actually were some required dose reductions because of neurotoxicity, but it goes away pretty quickly.
Is that your clinical impression also?
Yes.